This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Oh, good morning, everybody. So this morning we're doing Shosan, or Dharma Encounter. So this is a part of our tradition's training. And since the time of the Buddha, when he was the teacher, and he would teach, and students would engage him in questions. And that tradition has continued down to this time. And sometimes those teachings and the questions and their responses were communicating aspects of the teachings to help a person understand where they were, and in a sense what this is about, and sort of helping them to develop a right understanding. And sometimes those teachings were more direct, more pointed to directly into the mind, the heart of the student, trying not to so much inform them, but to awaken them. And so we see records of such encounters in all of the traditions. We see them in other traditions as well, outside of Buddhism. In the Zen tradition, some of those encounters became the traditional koans that some of us study today. And so Shosan, or Dharma Encounter, is a living example of that happening in the present, where the teacher, in this case myself, Shosan Shi, the teacher of the Shosan, presents some aspect of the teaching, something to focus on, and then students come up one by one and present their understanding, ask a question, and the deepest intent is to brighten, awaken the mind, to clear away obstructions in the mind, false views, and to shift our way of seeing and understanding. And in that way, we transform our lives and we transform the lives of others. And so it's very much in the present, it's on the spot. Nobody knows what, I'm going to speak about. I didn't even know. I thought I did, actually. but then, as a result of things unfolding during the earlier part of this morning, I felt that I needed to put that plan aside and strike out in a new direction. So we'll all be encountering this more or less at the same time. And clearly I don't know what your questions are going to be, so it's live. And it's a way for us to study ourselves, study the Dharma, and to do that together. Students in training have the opportunity to do Doksan, or Daisan, which is face-to-face teaching, but that's private. No one else ever sees that. We ask students to keep that confidential because it's their own study, it's their own practice, and so really nobody knows what goes on for anybody else except oneself, which is kind of marvelous, really. But this is a way to bring that out, and so it has both a private and a public nature to it, which makes it very live. So what I wanted to focus on this morning is a passage, just a short passage from the fascicle that we're studying in Master Dogen. Dogen is a 13th century Zen master who is part of our lineage, one of the most important teachers in our lineage. And this fascicle, his teaching that we're studying, is called Body-Mind Study of the Way. And so the passage I want to look at is, he says, Now, mountains, rivers, earth, the sun, the moon, and stars are mind. At just this moment, what is it that appears directly in front of you? The sun, moon, and stars, as seen by humans and by devas, are not the same. And the views of various beings differ widely. Views about one mind differ as well. Yet these views are nothing but mind. Is this mind inside or outside? Does it come or go? Is there more of it at birth or not? Is there less of it at death or not? How do we understand this birth and death and views of birth and death? And so here we can understand birth and death as everything. How do we understand this everything? In other words, anything that you point at, anything that you perceive, anything that you experience, anything that you think, anything you believe. How do we understand this and our views of this everything? Dada Roshi used to often say, profoundly trust in yourself. And the question that often comes up for students is, what am I trusting when I profoundly trust in myself? Is it my intuition? Is it my desires, my beliefs, what I feel in my heart, my ideas? When you say something or something happens and I respond, is that my intuition? Is that spontaneous response that's coming from a place that's true? Or is that a reaction, a reactionary response that's coming from my conditioning? Do I trust what arises that comes out of my conditioning, my socialization, my views and experience? Is that what I'm trusting? Is all of that wrong? Is none of that trustworthy? Is all of it trustworthy? Do I trust my basic nature, Buddha nature, which we could say expresses itself as my desire for happiness and my desire not to suffer? Are those two different? My conditioned, socialized views and experiences and those perceptions and experiences that seem to arise from what I might call a deeper place. Views in Buddhism are not just mental ideas, not just in Buddhism, but in the human realm. Shoham gave a talk earlier this week. We talked about the relationship between thoughts and feelings. When we have a thought, if we look carefully, most thoughts have some emotive content. They're not just purely words that are conveying some meaning. There's a sensory experience of those, of that thought on some level, if we look closely. Are those views, the views that you have, the views that I have, the views that we came in with when we began studying the Dharma, the views that we respond to things with, the views that we see through when we encounter ourselves and others? Do those belong to you, your views? Do my views belong to me? In other words, are they wholly my creation? Were they given to me? Were they imposed upon me? Did I create them myself? Are those distinct? So what I want to look at and try and keep this in a sense simple is, given what Dogen is saying, that the sun, the moon, the stars, as seen by human beings and devas, are not the same. So we would think of the sun, the moon, the stars as just beings, things that exist. When you look at the sun and when I look at the sun, we see the same thing. Right? Now, when a squirrel looks at the sun or a flower looks at the sun, we might be willing to grant that they might see something differently. But in the human realm, we we operate under the assumption that when we look at an object of nature, let's say, to keep it a little simple to begin with, that we're seeing the same thing. Is that true? The sun, the moon, and stars as seen by humans and by devas are not the same, and the views of various beings differ widely. And of course, we know that. We see that every day, everywhere. And the consequences of that. So what I want to look at is, to how do you hold a view? Is that view true? How do you know? What does that mean that it's true? According to what? According to whom? So we can think of views that are based on evidence. Right? If I walk out the door and follow the driveway straight ahead, I'll reach the road. I do that, you do that. The evidence seems to confirm that view as being true. And there are many such views. There are other views that are based on perceptions and emotions and aesthetics, for that matter, that we might call subjective views. Are those different kinds of views distinct? In other words, are they completely separated in the mind and the experience of the viewer? So within the realm of views and within the tradition of Buddhism, and trying to understand this, one danger is we fall into a kind of relativism, right? Because every being sees something differently. Every being has different views. And so what you see is right for you. What I see is right for me. That's not what Buddhism teaches. That's not what the Buddha said is a true path. We could also fall into a dogmatic path. What I see is true and correct. If you agree with me, then your view is true and correct. If you don't agree with me, then you're wrong. Right? So that's another approach to how do we hold a view. We could have a sense of indifference. Right? Sometimes people interpret Buddhism that way. The great way is not difficult, just avoid picking and choosing. And so sometimes I've met students, usually young students, who when I ask a question, it's like, either way is okay. In other words, I'm not landing anywhere. I abide nowhere. So that's another danger, right? Because it's not true. It's not an authentic experience. It's a put-upon kind of thing. That's another danger. And then there's another danger of falling into nihilism. Right? It doesn't matter. I don't care. Or that either view is the same, right? Because things are just going to play themselves out as they do. Isn't that what karma means? So all of these possibilities are things that Buddhism does not teach and actually warns against. But we might be able to relate to all of these different possibilities and more. And so within the realm of views, it's the first of the Eightfold Path, right view, right understanding. How do you trust yourself, to profoundly trust yourself? Because every movement we make, when we move towards the Dharma, when we move away from it, we're trusting something. When we hold on, when we let go, we're trusting something. What are we trusting? And how do we examine that, clarify, refine that, enlighten that? And then, most importantly, how do we meet another's view? Both when we agree, because although that seems easy, because it's easy, it's dangerous. And so what is the trap of that? So how do I meet another's view when they seem to align? And then very importantly, how do I meet another's view when they clearly don't align? Do I fall into relativism? Do I become dogmatic? Am I indifferent? So how to do this, and do this, as these questions, of course, are being asked from within, from within this training hall, as Dharma practitioners. What are we being true to? What are we trusting? How do you be true to others? How do you be true to the Dharma? How do you be true to yourself? So that's what I want to look at. And so Roxon is the chief disciple, so he'll lead off. And then Sean sort of introduced, yes? So then those of you who are participating in the Ango can also can follow Roxon's lead and get online. And then Zuise will close up at the end.
Shosanchi. You asked about how I hold a view. And I think I hold a view lightly. My view of things, I hold lightly.
Do you have faith in this Dharma?
I do.
And have you committed your life to it?
I have.
How do you hold that view?
Lately.
You've staked your whole life on it.
Yes.
So what does lightly mean?
It means that it's not fixed. It moves. It changes. It is never one thing.
So how do you meet a view in another that seems to contradict or oppose or reject this view?
I hold it lightly. It too will change and shift.
But what about when they act upon that view towards you?
I do what must be done.
What does that mean?
It depends. It depends on the situation.
But towards what purpose?
Towards freedom?
Whose?
All of ours.
Okay. Those are good words. You know the rest. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Susanji. When you were just speaking about views, it's actually something I was thinking about.
Can you hear in the back?
Yes.
Okay.
I was thinking about that in reference more to what we see and hear in the news. And I wanted to make it more general. Mm-hmm. It'll come back to me. I mean, obviously, but just in terms of what we hear and what we see.
But what about that?
In the news? Well, I'm concerned. My feeling, and I've just been feeling this very strongly lately, is that there's a lot of different opinions and views, and some very strong views, and I have strong views mm-hmm. about it mm-hmm. as well. And sometimes I step back and I think, well, whose views are right?
Mm-hmm. So how do you know? How do you examine that and come to some understanding of that? What is the basis of a view being right? How do you understand that as a practitioner of the Dharma?
I feel for myself when I entertain other views and I wonder, well, maybe I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm not seeing something, or maybe I'm not mm-hmm. I'm not understanding something that they see. And I feel to myself when I step back and I think, well, wait a minute. I just feel when views are selfish.
Okay, but so then is it on the basis of what you feel that you determine whether the view is right or not?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, is that feeling trustworthy? I mean, feelings come and go fast and frequently. So is that feeling that you have trustworthy? Is that, as I said, is that your intuition? Is that coming out of your years of study? Or is that just your conditioning? Is that just your desire speaking?
I guess feeling is the right word, but I think I trust that intuition more now than I did certainly 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So it's just your own experience of your feeling that you use as a basis.
Well, if somebody's slaughtering somebody or somebody's not doing, if somebody's being outwardly cruel to someone, then I gauge that and say that's not right.
Okay, but what about all the many, many, many subtle things, more subtle things, which aren't even that much more subtle, but are complex? In other words, do you see the danger of just relying upon a feeling?
Yeah.
Feelings come and go. It's your feeling. It's subjective. So what does it mean to trust yourself? Because if you just deny that feeling, then from what are you acting? But if you're only basing it in that feeling, is that just your conditioned mind, right? Is that just your desire? Is that just your view, right? Remember, different beings not only see the world differently, they live in different worlds, right?
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking recently, you know, with the Beyond Fear work, I was thinking about confidence. And I was thinking, you know, as a white guy growing up in this world, in this society, you know, I was just began to examine my basic experience of my confidence, right? Before practice, you know, how that's changed within practice. And I began to think, how much of that actually belongs to me? How much of the confidence that I feel, that I trust, and that I act upon, in a sense, came as a result of my years of living and trying things and experiencing and working hard and failing and, you know, just the thing, life stuff. The thing that gives us confidence. And how much of it was gifted to me at others' expense, right? And so feelings are difficult. So what do you rely upon? What does, as a Buddha, what do Buddhas rely upon to understand? I mean, what's just a basic principle of how you decide whether something is true or not?
I mean, I want to look at it from where I'm hearing it from and looking at their point of view. Because it's not always, maybe it's not to my advantage, and just because I don't like it, because it's not to my advantage, maybe it's to somebody else's.
Okay, but that's true, and that's important, but that's also then just, in a sense, shifting the subjectivity. Okay. In other words, are there any principles that you can take refuge in, that you can rely upon, whether you're the you here in 2008, or the you here 2,000 years ago, or you here 2,000 years hence? Think about that, okay? Because you have taken vows in those very principles. May your life go well.
I've been asking myself, what is mind? And what is truth? And I can't say that I really know what those things are, or how I know them. But, you know, I think the question that I keep asking myself is, these days, it's kind of my koan is, am I aware? And what I notice is that awareness is here. There's awareness. Mm-hmm. And that on some level, I cannot find a place where there isn't awareness. Mm. And And like the truth, you know, I don't know that the truth is in the mind or in the heart, but what is happening in this moment as just life unfolds, it seems that I can kind of take refuge in that, that this is what is happening, and that the rest of it, any trying to figure it out, I don't really know. Mm-hmm. I'm confused. Mm-hmm. You know, and the thoughts come and go, and the feelings come and go. What I'm perceiving comes and goes, mm-hmm. but there's these constants. When I tune my mind into it, you know, it's not there all the time. But it's there when I inquire. Mm-hmm. There's awareness. There's perceiving. There's what is here in this moment. And yeah.
Okay. Well, you said a lot. Let me just say a couple of things in response. What you said about it seems the moments that awareness is everywhere. This is true. And so awareness is not, in Buddhism, is not just what we are doing with our mind. That's an aspect of it. But in the same way that Dogen says, the sun, moon, and stars, rivers, and valleys are mind. Mm-hmm. That everything you experience, every view, is mind. So clearly that's not just a function of our thinking process. He's talking about something much larger, much more immediate. And to not know, you know, there's a difference between being confused, which is sort of grappling, you know, with our various attachments, and being in a place of non-abiding, of not knowing, which is really the place of examination. And so to really ask that question, to know I am aware, and then to ask, what am I aware of? And in my awareness, what am I not aware of? What is right here before me that I am not seeing? And we can look at that at the deepest level, such as Dogen is speaking about. As the Buddha said, things are not as they seem. So here, something appears before me. I see something, and there's something true in that. But what am I not seeing? We can also look at that in terms of societally, socially conditioned. You know, as a white man, what am I not seeing? You know, so what I just said about being confident. So what does that do to my experience of being in the world when something that I might have taken so for granted, I begin to question and examine, what is that actually that I have been unquestioningly acting from? Is it arrogance? Is it presumption? Is it true? It opens a door, right? And that takes some trust. And so, and it's not confusion, it's a path towards understanding.
And with that, there's a groundlessness.
Get used to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not, again, it's not the groundlessness of, you know, it's learning to be comfortable within the reality of that rather than keep seeking a facsimile of solidity, mm-hmm. and certainty, which will always betray us. Mm-hmm. May your life go well.
Thank you. Shusanji. First of all, I wanted to say thank you for the practice and the teachings, because my views are much less fixed since I've been practicing, which helps. But I noticed that, well, let's say my views or my attention, when I'm asked or when it's presented to me to make a decision.
Hang on, is everything okay?
There's just constant feedback coming in and out, so I was just checking to see if there's anything that we can do to resolve it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure he wasn't getting ready to faint.
Everything's good up here.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was saying, yes, that when my view or my ability to make decisions or to support a decision
yeah.
is much clearer mm. when it's for somebody else, mm. my children mm. or somebody who comes to me. Mm. When it's about me, it sucks.
So what's the difference?
Well, I was trying to figure it out when I was online, in line, and one thing that strikes me is when it's about someone else, I'm completely open to that person mm-hmm. with no judgments. Mm-hmm. All I want mm-hmm. is for the whatever it mm-hmm. is to work. Mm-hmm. And when it's about me, I think I just cannot be that clear-minded.
Okay. Well, the what you're doing for others sounds a lot like love and compassion. And so as we let go in more and more of the grasping at the self, and the grasping, again, it's not neutral. You know, it has spectrums of qualities. It has a lot of negativity. It has, I mean, in a sense, it's all various forms of negativity because it's binding, right? But sometimes it appears as good, but it's the negativity is in it binding nature itself. Sometimes it appears as negativity, and its binding nature is negative, you see. And so the more we let go of that grasping, that binding, then there is someone who needs your help, and it's you. And you can regard that person the same way you regard the other. May your life go well.
Shasanchi, there are views that threaten the existence of various groups of people. There are views that threaten the planet that we all live on.
Yeah.
There are views of people I know in the Sangha that make my heart pound mm-hmm. and that upset me. Mm-hmm. And that's within this beloved community. Mm-hmm. And then there's the world mm-hmm. where the views get more extreme. Mm-hmm.
And you?
I really don't know. This is such a question for me right now, you know? I mean, it's like I want to be broad and expansive, but like, you know, you can be broad and expansive and have your very existence threatened.
Yeah.
And I am definitely have the whole like fixed dogmatic thing down. I know how that goes. I feel well practiced in that. That is not working so well either. And so it is a real question for me about like, will human beings retain the ability to actually listen to each other, to listen to themselves, and to let each other live?
Yeah. Well, I think maybe it's fair to say if we actually lose that capacity, then we have become something else altogether. And so, but as with so many things that we see, things that can be inherent, you know, things within us become unpracticed, right? We lose touch with them, and then they become foreign. And as that teacher I quoted yesterday said, then we turn, you know, towards strangers. Or strangeness to try and understand. And so, you know, as practitioners, we are, you know, in every moment facing our own views. And that's so essential because, you know, we have to see our own, you know, bodhisattva, the one who is expansive. We have to see our own tyrant, the one who is dogmatic. We have to see our own indifference, the apathetic, the cynic, right, the skeptic, all of that. And really understand, you know, where that arises from. You know, what are we trying to do? If we look at everything that arises within us as karma, karmic, but it's the expression of a desire that's has been fulfilled and is seeking further fulfillment. And so when we encounter that dogmatic self or whatever it might be, you know, what desire are we trying to satisfy?
But aren't there situations that require, like, no?
Yes. Yes. There are moments where no is yes. You know, the Heart Sutra, one of the seniors was talking about that this week, that all of those no's are affirmations of everything that you are, that I am, that this is. And so we can think of a no that is based in what as an affirmation?
Life, love.
Yeah. And what about life and love?
They're good.
Yeah. And we want more of it, right? That we are working on behalf and for and as beings of life and love. You know, I'm reading this book by Bell Hooks, and she talks about, it's all about love is the title. And she talks about an ethic, a social ethic of love. And it's so simple. And it's so strange, right? It's so much who we are, and yet that can become so strange, you know, has become so strange in our time. And so, you know, but there are people everywhere and here too who are working on behalf of that. And so, but as you say, and the important thing here, because as practitioners with this great vow to be working towards the compassion, with compassion towards the benefit of all, then, and that really means everyone, you know, so that when, you know, when I heard that person at the conference or the meeting in Union Theological, a Buddhist action, and somebody said, you know, I go to all these activist groups, they're very progressive, and the thing they have in common is who they hate. And he said, that's not really the basis for movement. And so...
So how do you not hate someone who hates you?
Yeah.
How do you not hate someone who wants to actually kill people, you or others that you care about, or the, you know, I mean, I know that the hatred ends up eating you up.
Okay. Where does every action begin? Before there's action, before you take a step.
In the mind.
But what's happening in that mind?
Intention.
Yeah. You want something. So you may feel hatred, I may feel hatred, or I may feel threatened, you know, and so I feel defensiveness. And I see that as a practitioner. And I see that at the same time, hopefully, or maybe a little later, that I see my vow. I see that defensiveness, or I see that hatred, and I have made a commitment that it's here now, and so I must practice this, but that's not what I want my life to be about. That's not what I want to grow in this garden. And so it means I have to find ways of both recognizing, right? So I'm not rejecting or suppressing that, right? So that's where the feeling is communicating something, right? So it's not about that. It's not about the emotion. But if it's only about the emotion, you know, then I'm just in cycling. And so each of us, and together, have to find our way. And doing it together is so much better. But it's slow, you know, and we've talked about this. We talked about this week. Yeah.
Hurry up, world.
I agree. May it look good.
Sanji, I try to be aware of my views and to listen, but and I can have strong responses, but I feel that I'm committed. I try to really be a loving presence. That with each other view I meet, and I feel like I'm in a way that's all I feel like I'm really able to do. Mm-hmm. That it's so overwhelming otherwise.
Well, I mean, that's certainly part of it. I mean, if we can't tolerate and be patient within our own discomfort, little else will happen. Or rather, what will happen, we've already visited, right? We're just going to continue that samsaric cycle because we will do everything possible to avoid that basic discomfort that we're feeling inside, which our mind then makes sense of as to whether either why I deserve to feel that or don't deserve to feel that. You know, whose fault is it, basically? And so that's why Zazen is so marvelous, right? Because you are on that cushion and you make a commitment to not get away, right? And so there it is. It's full blown. It's not romantic. It's not spiritual. It just sucks, right?
Yeah.
And you see all of those strategies appearing, right? All of them. And we employ them. We employ them. And then until finally, you know, you exhaust yourself, right? And then we begin to actually turn towards ourselves. We turn towards the Dharma. And isn't that training us to do exactly the same thing? When we meet others' discomfort that they cannot hold, and so they lash out, and the they here is we, is everyone. And so we lash out with anger, we lash out with hatred, you know, and we know how to get into people, right, and provoke them, and we do that, right? And also our own discomfort at experiencing them. So we have to tolerate their discomfort and our experience of that that's happening right here. Because again, if we don't, we will just perpetuate the same patterns. And so, you know, that's why I was talking to Greg Snyder recently, who, you know, is a friend and a teacher and, you know, is committed to this work. And he said, I don't know if I should say this publicly, but he said, I will. He said he doesn't believe that it's possible to do this work without some kind of meditative practice, right? Some way that's not just intellectual or theoretical, you know, I am going to be patient, but you have to actually do it in the moment that is the most difficult, that you are wanting to squirm out of more than anything, right? And so, but then what is all of this for? It's so that we can actually step forward and have difficult conversations. We can engage in things that we would prefer not to engage in, right? But need to be engaged. So it's for stepping off of that 100-foot pole.
I just wanted to share, I started a morning practice where I hold everyone and wish that every person will see something real. Like see a tree or mm-hmm. a bird or mm-hmm. or like and that helps me mm-hmm. like hold that we can
yes.
all someday.
We like, can. And you know, then a way of taking that practice a little bit further is sit down and watch a news channel of a news channel that you vehemently disagree with. Right? And as you're facing those people and hearing those views, feel your own discomfort, right? See what practice there, because it's safe, right? Although even in that moment, it won't feel safe, right? It's just a way of practicing stepping forward, right? I have some of these channels bookmarked, right? It's good practice.
Thank you for the teaching. Shosanshi. Thank you.
Closer. No, I think that's close enough.
So I have very strong views, and for most of my life I felt very much like I didn't have room to express them. Mm-hmm. So as part of my practice, mm-hmm. I have been trying to speak.
Yes.
With knowing that it has consequences mm-hmm. that I can't control.
Mm-hmm.
And
so how have you been going about that? How have you been practicing? What moments? What do you choose or choose you to do that?
Well, so I choose ones that mostly that feel relatively safe, mm-hmm. like open sozan or dharma encounter.
Or doksan.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And And one thing I find is that, well, several things. One is that if it's a public forum, other people share my views. Mm-hmm. I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, I'm not so skillful because I have no practice.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a bit, sometimes I drop a bomb.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's consequences.
Yeah. It's got to be that way, right? How could we be skillful? I mean, it's just not going to be possible, right? And so we have to allow our clumsiness as we, you know, every time I've, you know, just in my life here, as I ventured into something new that was very much about my life, but was not, I had never ventured into before, or maybe we had not ventured into as a Sangha. And so in doing my own internal work, reflecting on when we began the Earth Initiative, when we began the Beyond Fear work, but speaking about it is a whole nother thing, right? And in the beginning, it felt very clumsy, but I knew I had to do it because otherwise it wouldn't get practiced, and that there would be consequences, and there were, right? That, you know, where, you know, I would hear back from people who agreed and didn't agree. And so, and that was difficult and most important, you know, because not only did it help me to learn, but it helped me to tolerate that clumsiness, where that wasn't the showstopper. You know, it just becomes more normalized. And in the process, we just become people, you know, trying to develop. And that anytime we're developing into a new terrain, it's going to be uncomfortable and clumsy, and there will be consequences. And that's why, you know, where we, in the moments when we can choose, that's so important. So within a community that can hold that, right? And that even in doing that, I imagine, well, you know, that there'd be moments where we might be more conscious and sort of holding how that's being expressed, and other moments where it might just come ripping out, right? Can we hold that for each other? Because it's not just for you, right? Because not only do people hold the views that you might express, some of them might not. But that's an example of someone who is exposing herself, making herself vulnerable, and we can do that. And we see that, right? And so it emboldens us. Thank you. May your life go well. But it ain't always easy on both sides. You know, that's why being a Sangha, being in actual relationship, makes so much more possible.
Sanji. I can feel all my walls caving in. And it's one of the most terrifying things I think I've ever experienced.
Can you see what the fear is of?
Because everybody else comes in.
Mm-hmm. And then what might happen in the mind of that fear? What will happen? What might happen?
My views aren't number one anymore. I'm not the first in line.
Yeah. Have to make some room.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting that, you know, if we look at when you encounter something that makes you uncomfortable, that's a kind of a loss of equilibrium, right? And so it's like when you lose your balance, you know, the first order of business is to regain your balance. You can't do anything else. You know, you can't have a cup of tea. You can't finish tying your shoes. You know, you can't do anything else. You have to restore your balance. And then you can proceed. And so in a much deeper way, in a much more fundamental way, every time this sense of self, which means all of those views, so many of which, if not most of which, are hidden, and yet are completely trusted, being acted upon, are who I am, are what the world is, are being threatened, right? That loss of equilibrium is not an abstract thing. It's survival, right? And that's why the defensiveness, I mean, that's a evolutionary response to the threat of extinction, to the threat of death, right? And so to just, if we can recognize that when we feel that discomfort, that that's what's happening. And that if we can stay in that loss of equilibrium, right? Actually, rather than just regain our balance, which means rein in our views and push out the others, you know? So when somebody meets us and says, you know, what you said really hurt me, and I say, no, that's not what I meant. You misunderstood. And I explained to you why your experience was invalid, right? That restores my sense of equilibrium. And what that means is I don't have to do anything. I don't have to shift. I don't have to make any space for what? For you, for another world, for a larger world, right? For your suffering. I don't have to see myself as being someone who just hurt you because I don't want to be that person. And so we have to develop the capacity to abide within that discomfort. Right. And then and continue to be attentive to this and to this. And just like we've been talking about, that's a skill, you know, that we are practicing in Zazen. But it's, you know, to just face our own mind, as difficult as that is, you know, when you're threatening yourself, that's one thing. But when it's coming from a perceived other, from the outside, particularly if that other is someone that you've been conditioned, trained to see as dangerous, or to see as less, or, you know, to disregard, that's a whole nother level of threat. And it requires a whole nother level of commitment and trust and faith and love. And so this question of what is it actually based in, you know, what is true, it has to be based in the desire to live in a world of compassion and love.
I think the hardest part about this process for me right now is I'm watching myself repeat that defense mechanism over and over and over again and know that I'm doing it. And still, it's almost like it's like I can't even control it sometimes, where it's like, you know, I'm watching myself tear the world apart and I don't want it anymore.
Yeah. Let me ask a question. How many of you understand what Stephen is saying? Look around. May your life go well. I mean, isn't that part of the shame, is that we think, you know, we're the one?
Sasanchi, I was thinking about what you were saying about confidence, and about how much of our viewpoint and our experience is kind of gifted to us in a way, especially we're raised in privilege. And, you know, in the last 10 years, like, practice has kind of blown holes in a lot of that viewpoint, where now my viewpoint is completely different. And I thought about...
Completely different.
Completely different.
Completely different.
I think so. I still... There's still leftovers.
Oh, so not completely.
But I thought about practicing with our Sangha in Greenhaven, and their experience and the formation of their viewpoints comes from a very different place. And, you know, I see the hurt child, and I see the person who wants to better themselves, and I see the murderer. And how do I hold that within myself, you know, from as a viewpoint?
How?
Try to open my heart and try to stay open.
And so how can you make your view more expansive? How can they help you make your view more expansive?
I think in seeing how I was so sure of my viewpoint before, and now I'm not, that truth that I held for so long was not really true.
Yeah. But how does that come about? Because that's not a static process. What can you do in their presence to let your own view become more expansive?
Listen.
See. Ask. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shashanchi, I think of the Metta Sutra where the last part says, but by not holding two fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, is not born again into this world. Mm-hmm. And I think that's galatial. Mm-hmm. I just live in the fray of living and dying, mm-hmm. like, constantly. Mm-hmm. But that pure-hearted one, I know, is possible. Mm-hmm. But those views, man.
Yeah, and more than possible.
Present.
Yes.
Present, always.
Yeah. It's not, the Buddha didn't say, you know, all sentient beings will have Buddha nature when they fulfill the necessary requirements.
I think I read that.
So from the beginning. But, you know, on the one hand, we do because we're so impatient as a culture, we're so presumptuous in a sense, in our sense of being able to control and, you know, just let go of our attachments and our ancient, you know, habit energies. And so we have to be humbled, you know, by meeting them over and over. And then we begin to, and we have a truer and truer understanding of self and other, of this world, of this mind, of practice, the whole catastrophe. But at the same time, so that helps us to sort of temper our impatience. But at the same time, that can become just another expectation. It's going to take so long. So we slow down, you know, we become complacent or lazy. And so that's why patience on the one hand and urgency is so important.
Yeah, so I could see why Greg says meditation, because in that moment when it's happening,
right.
It's like, man, it splatters, and then it's like you got to keep like at it,
right.
As it's like ripping to shreds and dying, and like there's a person and there's people and there's all that possibility to hold there.
Yes. I think of the, you know, the end of each evening during our normal schedule when we, you know, we finished our day, we're sitting, you know, and you're sitting and your mind is still and the day's finished and you feel you're going to bed and that's good and you're just, you can let it all drop and then let me respectfully remind you.
Yeah.
Go to bed with that. Yeah. Sweet dreams. At the end of each evening, we chant, let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by, an opportunity is lost. Each of us should strive to awaken, take heed, do not squander this life.
So, Shachi, when I'm very bothered by the other person's other views, I usually see that I've kind of made them small, as in narrowed them down to that view.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Yes.
And so to, in the moment of this separation, to keep like the bigger view, that is kind of like the task.
Yeah. Well, you know, one way of cultivating compassion is, you know, when we encounter something that we find very difficult or dangerous or offensive, and not just that we find that it is, but it is, that rather than thinking in our minds or asking, you know, how can you be like this? Who are you? You know, what kind of person are you? That we ask, in a sense, what has happened to you? Right? What is your life? What has your life been? Whether that's this morning's life or, you know, years of life. Because, and it's not that each of us are not, we are each responsible for our actions, but we also have experienced a lifetime of things, you know, that have helped to forge those views and forge this person that we put forth. And some of us have put that together and had help to put that together in a way that comes forth, you know, with generosity and kindness, and others in a very different way. But all of us come forth by that process of karmic consequences.
Yeah, I wonder in that context often, is there truly actually evil, or is there actually just hurt? As in like where this rises out of.
Mm.
It's hard to be this open.
Yeah.
And I also, as Arjun mentioned the Metta Sutra, I hope to have that, like that line in the moment to hold on, like may all beings be at ease.
Yeah.
And
well, that's why we train. So if you work with that, actually, you know, it's like what Bruce Lee said, something like, you know, in the moment of meeting, you know, our adversary or a difficult moment, you know, we don't retreat to our ideas, we retreat to our training. We fall back onto our training because that's what we've actually cultivated as our embodied experience. May your life go well. That is, if we're training.
Shosanchi? Very early in my residence, I had a short argument with one of the longer-term residents about the issue of the Antifa's movement, the Black Bloc movement. My side of the argument is essentially that I tend to have a certain amount of respect for that movement. I feel that, especially in protests with how divided our world is and with how much violence the other side, the quote-unquote opposing side, brings to certain protests, I think that it's valuable to have a certain segment of the population who's in some way willing to put themselves kind of in between the violence and the people who are trying to peacefully protest. But a little bit later, I began to wonder, is that actually what I believe? Or is it something that I've read in a book and I sort of absorbing that? And so I've been sort of wondering, as I was waiting, how do you hold the view? And what are my views? And I think that the way that you would hold the view, I find, is lightly but with conviction, similar to what one of the teachers said earlier this week. You hold this practice lightly but with deadly seriousness.
Yeah, I mean, you know, without faith and commitment, nothing will happen. And yet within that commitment, very easily we can become attached. Right? It's almost certain that we will, because that's our mode. And so to practice caring that deeply, being that committed, and holding lightly means to continually be aware of the ways in which we might be grasping. Because that then becomes binding, even when what we're grasping at is good, or the initial desire is good. And I think what, you know, what's really important as practitioners is that in terms of establishing views, that we need. You know, I came here originally having, you know, lived my life in practice for 10 years because I realized I need something more than I am able to access within myself. I didn't think of it as views, or I wasn't really thinking of it concretely. But when I met it, I realized I needed the views of those who have seen what I haven't seen. I need the teachings of those who have realized what I haven't realized, right? I need forms of training, ways to practice, things to do with my mind and my body and my words, that I can't just rely upon my own experience. That's too small. It's limited and it's too cloudy. And so the basic teachings of ceasing from harm, practicing good, actualizing good for others, practicing the precepts, affirming life rather than destroying life. I mean, those are basic fundamental principles of human life, regardless of one's tradition or no tradition, that are guiding forces, can be guiding forces for how we, not just how we think about things, but how we live amongst things. It's how it can be how it is how we, what we're given to actually see into situations and try and make decisions about what is the best way forward, right? Particularly when anything I do is going to cause some harm. So what is the least amount of harm? And the practice of trying to see through our selfishness so that we're moving more and more from a selfless place. So, you know, to just sit and sort of rely on my feelings or my own, kind of come up with my own philosophy of the world, I mean, you know, others may want to do that. That wasn't, I just did not have faith in that, in my capacity to come up with something that I thought was going to be reliable because I'd been given it a good shot.
So I wonder then if the idea of this practice is to come to know ourselves, myself, through the practice of emptiness and the practice of spaciousness. When you are practicing spaciousness and you are trying to construct a morality, if you will,
you don't have to construct a morality. Just live morality. Practice morality. Be morality. The moment we start constructing it, it becomes righteousness. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanshi, at the beginning of the Dharma encounter, you said something like that the main thing that we're doing here is to, with this, is to awaken mm-hmm. the mind mm-hmm. and to illumine false views. And I was reflecting that what makes that possible is that we have agreed to do so. Mm-hmm. Right? I have made a vow to awaken mm-hmm. and to illumine my mind, mm-hmm. and I have asked you to teach me and help me to do that. I have asked the Sangha to help me do that. But what is the most skillful way to respond when that agreement is not there? When yeah. somebody says something that is hurtful or mm-hmm. killing words, and they have not asked for anything, certainly yeah. of me.
Right, or they don't care.
Or they don't care.
Yeah, or they want to hurt you. Yes, absolutely. But you know, the fact that we meet each other in that agreement makes it easier, more possible. But it's always possible because that's our basic nature. It's always possible because everything is in flux, because nothing is fixed. Even the most, you know, dark, recalcitrant, fixated, opinionated, you know, blind, et cetera, human being, right? That their stuff is your stuff, right? And that can be the psychological, you know, it can be the spiritual, Buddha nature, you know. Of course, the details are different, but not so different, right? That we can't communicate, that we can't understand. Find some understanding. Of course, willingness, you know, is how we open the door. So how do you meet someone when they've closed the door? Or when they're slamming the door in your face, right? This is the most difficult thing, right? So I don't have all the answers for that. But, you know, I have practice, and we have practice together, and we have things we can turn towards, because that's just a way of describing what will be an actual experience in a moment with you and an actual person,
yeah,
right? And so we can't predict that. We can't, you know, formulate a strategy in advance, but we can examine ourselves deeply and you know, illuminate and release all of those things that get in the way for us in that moment, are getting in the way for that person in that moment. And in the process, we gain understanding. Right? Not just understanding of this mind that we see before us, but causation, karma. And even if we don't know what has happened, we know something has happened.
Well, I think, yeah, I was thinking of an event, you know, it was with my family
And we were having dinner, and one of my relatives, my uncle, made a racist comment. And by the time I realized what had actually happened, mm-hmm. we had moved on. Mm-hmm. So I did not respond, which, of course, is a way of responding. And afterwards, I was reflecting on it and reflecting, you know, how could I have done that differently?
Yeah.
And first of all, I feel I needed, I do still need more facility to realize in that moment something's happening, even when it happens so fast.
Yeah.
If I had been able to, in some way, by asking a question or by doing something, create a little bit of a space to maybe have a different conversation instead of letting just a moment pass,
yeah. and
everybody having the experience, whatever experience
yeah.
each person at that yeah. table had.
Right.
But that was the first thing, is by the time I realized that I guess it wasn't gone, but in a way it was past.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, you know, it's a practice. I remember a similar situation with my family where my nephew said something that was racist, and I did say something that was not very skillful. So I did something, and I had, and you know, having experienced many, many, many times before where I had not, and that was my response. And so I did respond, but not very well, right? But then, you know, as a practitioner and understanding karma, then you reflect on it, right? Not so that you could have a prepared response for the next moment, but just so that we can learn and keep developing in every way possible our capacity to meet, you know, the present need. And so, I mean, that's where acceptance of our everything within, you know, the great urgency of now is a kind of exquisite dance. Mary Life Goel.
Thank you for your teaching.
I was thinking this morning, I just want to say a few words and finish. I was thinking this morning of the Buddha in the moment when his aunt, who had raised him as his mother, because his birth mother had died, asked for him to ordain her, and her and many other women. And he said no. And I was thinking about how I've always considered that from the perspective of, why didn't you say yes right away? What were the reasons? You know, what was going on socially? You know, just trying, you know, what did scholars say? Why might he have said that? You know, all of this. And this morning I was thinking of it from the point of view of, you know, sort of inside trying to, you know, projecting in my mind, which was really means just projecting into myself, you know, of what it might have been for him in that moment, having been raised in that time, in that culture, where all the people that he saw who were people of power were men, and he was raised as a person of power. Where all the mendicants that he had encountered, the teachers, the spiritual seekers, the spiritual, adepts that he had encountered were men. Where he lived in a world, as I see it in my projection, where roles were clearly defined. And maybe he had never even thought about that. Maybe he had, but maybe he hadn't. And then in that moment, she asked him that question. And I wondered, you know, did that no have a defensiveness? Having developed his sangha up to that point, having forged a relationship with the lay community that was self-supporting, supporting the sangha, having dealt with all kinds of problems in trying to structure this newly formed thing that was happening, that was going to change the course of history, and his role in that as the teacher, and that what that might have been for him, that threat, that challenge, that why are you doing this to me? Right? Why are you presenting something like this to me? And not being able to look back and see a precedent or see anything that would give him a sense of a path forward or any comfort or assurance that could happen, that he could say yes, and did he even think yes is the right thing to do, but I don't know how to get there? A potent moment, right? And then identifying such moments with myself identifying with such moments where feeling something essential, something good, feeling under threat, whether it's me, whether it's this monastery. And that protective response, right, that is both personal and in other ways not personal, but is there a clear distinction? You know, to really take seriously the vows that we will chant in a moment, to take seriously the life of the Buddha, the teachings, our own practice, our lives, you know, continually is opening us up to so much more than we thought when we began. And I think that is such a good thing, that it doesn't, you can't see it all at the beginning. I think the hall would virtually be empty. Right? We're not ready yet. We're not ready yet. And even when we are ready and we meet that new challenge, we don't think we're ready. And that's the sign that we're ready. May we do this, continue to do this work together, the whole of it, and bring wisdom and compassion to all beings and really mean that. What does that mean? In a way that is both grounded and realistic, but is also in a way that is demands of us that we fulfill our vows. Just that.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.